Okay. My name is Earl, and I'm, of course, with Republic Magazine. We generally do have these webinars every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, and at the same time. And so be sure and join us for the ones that we have next week and every week thereafter. And what I want to do is let you know that I think we build this as being one special guest, but we actually are getting two for the price of one. And by being free, that's really a good price. So we have with us today Paula Stang and Trey Stennett. And what I'll do is I'll go ahead and initially I'll introduce Paula first. And Paula is a senior at the Houston Baptist University, majoring in honors history and political science. She's currently finishing her senior honors thesis on the Federal Reserve, entitled Fractional Reserve Banking and Fiat Currency, A Pattern of Profiteering. She's also the youngest delegate from Texas to the 2008 Republican National Convention. On November 23rd of this year, she was able to be one of the speakers at the End the Fed rally in Houston with Ron Paul. So that's very interesting. When I read that, I was very pleased to see that. And Trey Stennett, engaged to Paula Stang, is the young founder and CEO of the Liberty-inspired apparel line, Liberty First Apparel. At 19, Trey started his first small business in real estate. By the age of 21, he was a self-made millionaire. At 22, Trey traveled the country, giving lectures on real estate investing to over 5,000 people. In the financial collapse of 07 and 08, Trey discovered firsthand the effects monetary manipulation, fiat currency, and fractional reserve banking as he experienced a dramatic loss in equities, multiple foreclosures, and a corporate bankruptcy. In 2008, Trey and Paula met at the Republican Party of Texas Convention. They went on to be the youngest delegates to the Republican National Convention. In early 2009, Trey founded Liberty First Apparel, which he has taken across the nation from San Diego, California, to Hartford, Connecticut, 15 other states, and eventually to Washington, D.C. On September 12th, and Ron Paul's In the Fed rally in Houston on November 22nd, 2009. So with that, I think it might be good just to start with, telling us a little bit about, and it can go in whatever order. I mean, either one of you can speak up and the other one can add to or whatnot. But maybe give us a little bit of an idea of how each of you came around to be doing what you're doing today, and then begin to tell us a little bit about the fractional reserve banking and the Federal Reserve and those types of things, if you would. Do you want to go first, Paula?
Sure. I love hearing people's stories about how they became interested in politics and just the liberty movement in general. I know many of my friends, their stories are very interesting, and Trey, I think, has one as well, especially since I'm involved in it. But I don't really, since my father is my father, Alan Stang, I've certainly been hearing about it all of my life, so I don't think that my story is as interesting as Trey's. If you would like to go ahead and tell about what he's discovered, et cetera.
Sure. And probably since I was a young child, my parents have been very involved in local politics. We would always pay attention and watch the presidential debates and such, but as far as actually getting our hands dirty, we were involved in city council races and Justice of the Peace races and things like that, people where we could really have an opportunity to get to know the individuals that are running for the different positions. In doing that, you kind of, I guess, begin to assign certain characteristics and traits to people at larger levels, the state level, the national level, and you begin to believe that because the people at the local level may use similar descriptive adjudicates for themselves, albeit Christian, or maybe they say they're conservative or belong to a specific party. you start to believe that those traits assign to everyone. So for a long time, I was involved in politics since I was a young kid, including going to state conventions, senatorial conventions, which is actually where I was fortunate enough to meet Paula, was at the Republican Party of Texas convention. And I still wasn't completely awake, as I like to call it now, because I was still just treading water, assuming things about my national leaders. After we went to Minneapolis, Republican National Convention, and my eyes were really opened at that point as to the dichotomy of belief systems within the Republican Party, I began to look a little bit deeper. And with Paula kind of a guide and constantly giving me new information that I hadn't heard of, really began to look into different things. And I would say the biggest eye-opener, the most confounding thing that I was awakened to was the Federal Reserve System. I had heard that it was a private company that was actually put together in the early 1900s to save us from economic collapse during the Great Depression. Not only was the information incorrect, the timeline was off, and I just had went on assuming that that was the truth. But being engaged with somebody that's writing a 40-some-odd page paper on fiat currency kind of will open your mind to everything that's really going on. And I think that was kind of the experience that I went through. Was learning how everything that I had thought was true, not everything, but most things that I thought were true, kind of were a facade, kind of were assumptions that I had personally made, and maybe even lies or trickery to make me think that certain things are a way when they aren't actually like that.
And I think something interesting that Trey was very depressed and saddened when he started learning about these things, as were a lot of our other friends. And I think something that's interesting that young people have is that, you know, they're depressed about these things that they've assumed they're not true, and they learn about maybe what's really going on in the world, but then they bounce back and they want to do something about it, and they feel like they have their whole lives ahead of them, and it's difficult deciding what decisions to make, but you know that you have to do something.
Yeah, I agree. You know, when I first started looking a little bit deeper, or as I like to say with my friends, going a little deeper down the rabbit hole, and began to discover some of the things that our leaders are involved in, and some of the decisions that have been made, why they've been made, and sometimes exact opposite reasons and methods being reported to the general public, I began to become very depressed, because in my mind, since I was 15 years old, I had concocted this story where, you know, I would grow up and go to college and do all the right things and maybe run for senator or president of the United States someday. And when I discovered what is really going on behind the scenes, it kind of became very depressing for me. And for about 3 or 4 days there, I just wanted to give up on the whole political scene. And you know, with my recent successes and subsequent failures and real estate and stuff, I really was looking for direction. I didn't know where to go, what to do. And I think born out of that confusion and out of that sudden overwhelming information overload, I decided to start the Liberty First Apparel Company with Paula, something that would allow me to learn more in politics, to express a belief system, but at the same time rebound and make some money. So that's kind of where that came from. And in addition to that, being able to be involved in the Fed Houston event last month, putting it together where Ron Paul came and spoke, and being able to be part of, continue to be part of, the different Republican party, for instance, the Young Republicans of Houston and of Texas and national. We've gone to all those conventions to be able to be part of that and spread a message of liberty to be able to awaken more people. So really what started out as confusion and depression turned into an overwhelming passion and desire to not only spend my social time, but also my work time on trying to spread this message of liberty.
Well, you know, that's quite a shift from all the way from being a voter for McCain to you know, the supporter of the principles that Ron Paul stands for. It must have been quite a earth-shattering shift to go that way and to believe that everything was just pretty much like it looked like on the surface, and then to realize what's really going on. And I applaud you for making such a shift. It must have been a challenging thing, I would say.
Well, I can tell you it wasn't easy. And when I say it wasn't easy, I don't mean for me. It wasn't easy for Paula, being my girlfriend at the time, trying to share this information with me, but to tread lightly. Because if she says something that seems a little bit too conspiratorial, I might just run away, which never would have happened. But I think that may be what she thought.
I did.
Well, you know, being of course, I've known of Alan Stang for so many years, going back to my college days. And in fact, I even brought him in as a speaker one time and had quite an attendance at the event that he spoke at, and he did a fantastic job. He's a prolific writer, speaker, and of course, I say the late Alan Stang. He was quite a passing for him to no longer be with us doing the work that he did for so long. But it's great to see that the many that continue to carry the work on. And I think you're probably seeing, along with everyone else, that people are waking up faster today than at any time that any of us that have been in this for a while can remember. And the amount of people that are quite young are coming into this type of movement and this type of activism. And that's what's so encouraging to so many of us. You're probably seeing that too, right? A lot of people that are waking up.
Well, you know, my parents, my mother, sometimes she would be frustrated with, you know, education and what people understood and what they were learning about. But I think something that's really been exciting for both of my parents and for I as well, is really technology and the internet. It will certainly increase the number of people who are educating themselves and what their I'm sorry, I was distracted. It'll increase the number of people, what they're reading about and what they're able to find online. And it also creates such a wonderful place for all kinds of people to write and to tell people about what they're learning themselves. I mean, I think it really spreads what is going on like never before. And that's something that my parents' generation certainly didn't have, even though my dad was writing books and traveling the country speaking. He didn't have this medium, I guess, of the internet like we have now.
It's really revolutionized the liberty movement. I was speaking with a few of my friends the other night when we were kind of going over everything that happened in the Fed rally, and we were discussing how the internet is something extremely difficult for the elites in our country and other countries to control. They do have ICANN, which I've been reading a lot about the cybersecurity bill and stuff like that right now that might be going through. But as of yet, they have been very, very ineffective in limiting blogs. A lot of young people, and when I say young, I don't just mean teenagers and 20s. I mean people into their 40s are putting more and more weight into blogs and paying attention less and less to not only the Washington Post and that they get in paper form, but also they're not reading these same institutions' websites. They're looking for something that is true and something that is free and uninhibited by the FCC, which I think one of the phrases that we used the other night was that we may see that the internet was the savior of our liberty, because whereas before the internet came around, you had a very big limitation on what you were able to get out there. You had blacklisted authors who couldn't get published. You had people that couldn't get onto television network programs or onto radio programs. And I think that control was as effective in indoctrinating the adult population as public schools have been at indoctrinating the youth. And now, for the first time in history, a young child, you know, somebody that's 16 years old and has a political view sitting in, you know, his house in West Virginia, can have a political idea that can be heard by tens of thousands of people in an instant. You know, that wasn't even around, you know, during our founding. So I think that really has revolutionized the Liberty Movement has revolutionized the ability to get truth into more people's homes. More people can be open to it and awake to it if they'll turn off the TVs and turn on their computers. And, you know, we're very fortunate. I mean, you look at the Ron Paul election last year, or you look at the End of Fed movement, or you look at just the Liberty Movement in general. There are blogs and TV shows and new websites that are popping up all the time, every day, connecting people, people that find each other. You look at recently this Acorn investigation with James O'Keefe and Hannah Giles. They met over Facebook. I mean, it shows you how like-minded people can be connected across the continent to fight together for the cause of liberty.
That's really great, because we the different movements, what is it called, the YAL, Young Americans for Liberty, and those different organizations like that. I know that Ron Paul would call the internet the great equalizer in regards to the media. You know, it give another alternative way, and it's, like you said, growing very fast and really getting the word out. It's so rapid. I mean, information can just blast out and be everywhere instantly. I know that you know a good bit about the Texas politics and the governorship of Texas. Could you maybe say a little bit on that?
Well, Trey would be better for that, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, we... My family has, like I said, always been involved in Texas politics, and you know, we do the official song and dance during the primaries, where we try and find who we believe is the candidate who most adequately believes what we believe, that is a conservative. And then in the general, we get rank and file behind everybody else who's voting for the Republican, because that's always the, quote, lesser of two evils. And I think that about 2 years ago, it was 2009, so 3 years ago, I still was pretty much, you know, just an avid conservative Republican follower, listening to, you know, your typical talk radio stations. And when I found out about Governor Rick Perry down here in Texas, when I found out about the executive order to mandate Gardasil shots to young girls in Texas schools, I was outraged. And I couldn't believe that a Republican conservative leader would tread that much on parents' rights, would tread that much on the right of individual choice. I didn't think that was a conservative principle. And so from that moment, I began to become very conspicuous of Governor Perry. And paying a little bit more attention over the last few months, looking at, you know, Governor Perry, Senator Hutchison, and the underdog Debra Medina, I began to really scrutinize each of them, and all I'm finding on Debra Medina is that a lot of my friends and my family are saying, well, you know, she sued the Republican Party of Texas last year right before the convention and during the convention, and, you know, I just can't get over that. And I think about comparing atrocities between that and what Senator Hutchison has done. She specifically voted for the TARP bill last year. She voted for the bailouts, among a lot of other things. Rick Perry with the Gardasil shots, you know, was very disheartening for me. Even the Trans-Texas corridor, part of the NAFTA superhighway, if you will, that's going to be stretching from Canada through Texas from Mexico and through Texas north to Canada. You know, I heard about that at the RPT last year, still before I had woken up, and I said, what? You know, how does that work? Researched it and found out that, in fact, this land that's being taken via eminent domain is going to be sold to foreign companies. And I was like, I could not believe that was something in Texas' best interest. And why would, again, a Republican conservative governor make a decision like that? And, you know, the list begins to go on and on with Governor Perry and his involvements and the conference he went to speak at in Istanbul in 2007. I am wondering how a governor plays a part with international decisions that are being made by non-governmental institutions, and all this stuff just mounts up. And those, I think, are more unforgivable than somebody who may have sued the Republican Party for just or unjust reasons. In my opinion, I'm still researching those. But in my opinion, that's that's just the comparison. Of course, K'Bay Hutchison being the other runner for it hasn't exactly done the best things for Texas as senator either. So.
Okay. Well, that's interesting to know, to have a little update on that. If I might, I'm going to shift a little bit to take a couple of questions that we have that have come in on the Internet. But before we do that, I just wanted to remind everybody that we're speaking with Paula Stang and Trace Tennant and young activists who have quite a bit of involvement and quite a bit to share with us. If you do have any questions for either or both of them, what you want to do is if you call into the conference bridge line, then just go ahead and dial *2 on your phone keypad, and we'll know that you want to ask a question and can unmute your line. If you have access on the Internet, there's a question box on the page, and just go ahead and type your question in and hit submit, and we'll make sure the question is asked. What I have is Dave from Millwood ask, is there a new U.S. currency waiting to be announced? Do either of you know anything about that?
Well, I think Trey knows a lot about it. I mean, he was telling me just the other day, I wasn't aware that, I hadn't heard that that was what they were discussing at the last G20 meeting.
There's been some speculation. You know, obviously you have to always check your sources and where you're getting your information from. But I've seen in several different sources that a large part of what they were speaking about at the G20 was talking about the fall of the U.S. dollar and what to do about it on an international. Obviously, it's the G20 scale. We've seen India buying by the ton gold from the IMF just in the last week. You've seen China, you've seen India, you've seen all these different governments that base, in a large way, their own currency, their own economic system off of a dollar reserve. And they're having to suck up a bunch of the inflation that's being caused right now with the trillions and trillions of dollars of, I'd say, printing, but I'd say only about 2% of our currency really is printed, so maybe digitizing. These dollars that are just being through fiat, the fiat dollars that through fractional reserve banking and through just creating it out of thin air and then using it, lending it to the government. I think there will be a move, probably away from the dollar. A lot of people have spoken about an Amero. More people right now are saying that we may skip that and go straight to international currency. No one really knows for sure, but there's definitely been talks of it, both in the public sector, and there's been a lot of quote, inside reporting where people are talking about moving from that U.S. dollar-backed currency to something international or something at least multinational.
Yeah, I really think it's inevitable that they will try and adopt a new currency. I don't know how, Americans will take it. I don't know whether Americans would think that, because obviously this will be presented as this will be safer, it will be more stable, et cetera, none of which will be true. But I don't know whether Americans will accept that. England, they've kept their pound because it's a tradition, they love the British pound, et cetera. Well, how will Americans feel if they're forced to use something else besides the dollar? I think it's interesting and I'm very concerned as to what will happen in the near future.
I'm confident in the American spirit. I think that there are a lot of people in our country, a lot of young people, a lot of politically involved people who are ready to take action. If something that internationalist comes down the pipeline, I really think that there's going to be a backlash. I really think that it will be difficult for the elite, if you will, to get something like that through over the American people without an extremely convincing reason. Like Paula said, we'll either be scared into it or we'll be enticed into it. And what I mean by enticed is Benjamin Franklin said that a man who's willing to give up his liberties for security deserves neither liberty nor security. And I think that is true, but the following statement is also true, is that a person willing to give up their liberty for convenience deserves neither. And I see a lot of that. I see a lot of people who, oh, I don't care about the red light camera. It's convenient. You know, oh, I don't care that, you know, the dollar is flexible. It's convenient to never have to take away a government program. It's convenient. And I think that it may either be passed as a, you know, through a scare tactic of, you know, the dollar has lost, you know, all of its value because of whatever reason they make up. We all know that 96 years since the Federal Reserve began, it's lost 96% of its value. So we know who to blame for that. But it'll either be passed, I think, through either fear or through an enticement of convenience. But there are a lot of awake Americans, and that number is growing and growing by leaps and bounds. I had a discussion with Paul and a few others a couple nights ago. I just asked, I said, how many people, since you got involved in Ron Paul's campaign, have woken up to what's going on in the world, going on with our nation for the last 100 years, just as a result of your efforts? And I know Paula personally. She said, well, I know four directly, and I don't know how many of those four have been woken up. Another gentleman that was at the table said three, another one said two. Well, that's not doubling you. I mean, when you're talking about three people becoming 12, that's quadrupling efforts. And I think that is very, very inspiring to see how much people are waking up to politics, and through their waking up, they're learning who to trust and who not to. And I think that movement is going to create a backlash against a move to a different currency.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right with what you're saying, and I'm hoping that the spirit and the passion for freedom burns strong enough in the American people that they will resist something like that, because I know that in the past we've fallen prey to what is often called the process of problem, reaction, solution. What they have is they have a solution in mind to a problem that they create or enhance, or have a lot of media whipped up about it. And because they know a certain reaction will occur and people will almost demand that particular solution, which is what they wanted all along. So that's a typical ploy that they've done, and I'm hoping that there's a monkey wrench thrown in it now. It's certainly time for that to happen. No more falling for that, like you said, the fear tactics or the inducement or whatever it is that they're trying to do. It's almost like a magician's trick. I have another question from, I think it's from the same Dave in Millwood, ask, is Executive Order 11-110 still in play to replace the fiat notes, the Fed fiat notes?
Well, you know, there's a lot of speculation on that. That what he's talking about is JFK, before his assassination, signed into law executive order that stated, kind of stripping the Federal Reserve of some of its power, that we were going to move back onto a silver-backed, silver standard dollar. Nothing has been done with it at this point. Obviously, it hasn't been carried out through policy. It also hasn't been removed or revoked by another executive order that we know of. So it's still there. It still stands. But short of getting somebody like Ron Paul into the Oval Office to carry that out, or short of having a move in Congress to legitimize it through an act, I don't see. I haven't heard any rumor about that becoming a reality anytime soon.
I really feel like that is, with what H.R. 1207 has done and how many co-sponsors it has, and, you know, it's even gotten to the point that Bernanke has written an article trying to, you know, defend the Federal Reserve. I mean, these are great strides, and I think Ron Paul's efforts are really what we need to focus on. I think that executive order, I don't know. I don't know if it's moot. I don't know if that would be the right word. But I think sometimes you have to pick where you have to focus your effort. So I think H.R. 1207 and the Senate bill are really, really exciting, and I think they have a lot of possibility of passing.
Okay. Dave and Millwood also ask, are arrests going to be made of the Fed and its accomplices for committing massive fraud against the American citizens?
Well, I'd love that. That'd be great.
I would too.
Yeah, I don't know if it would go so far as that. I think Ron Paul has said over and over that, you know, everyone knows that he would like to end the Fed, but many more people are interested in just at least auditing the Fed. And I think, you know, his belief is that once their actions have become transparent and we're able to see, you know, where has all this money gone and how are they just losing trillions of dollars, I think that, you know, that will really awaken people, and I think it will cause a call for a change in policy. I don't know if people will be arrested, as Trace said. That would be great. But I think if people find out what the Fed is really doing, people will demand a new monetary policy.
We want justice, and you know, I think that H.R. 1207 and the corresponding Senate bill, with a majority of Congress, a distinct majority of the House, backing this bill and being ready to vote on it, and just having the Paul Grayson amendment put back into it. For those of you who have been following 1207, you know that in committee it was basically gutted. They took the transparency portion out of the bill, the entire purpose of the bill, but an amendment passed, I think it was a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago now, to put that back in there. So 1207, the goal is to expose the Fed, to expose, you know, what Dave's asking about. What is, you know, what are these people's crimes? What will they be arrested for? Well, you know, we want the justice. We want to see them in handcuffs. But just as just, I want to see the American people's prosperity return to them. I want to see my dollar 100 years from now not being worth 4 cents again. That to me is a form of justice. But without transparency, without 1207, without the ability to audit and see where the money is going and who's pulling the strings, and they say if you want to know what's going on, you follow the money. Well, you know, what happens when you have a criminal syndicate like the Federal Reserve that doesn't allow you to follow the money? You know, if you can't follow it, you can't see what's going on, then how do you seek any kind of justice like that? But I like that question. When we were in Houston at the Fed rally the other day, they, of course, had some police cars show up for our little rally. Basically, it was interesting the way that they were positioned. They didn't have cop cars all around us on all sides. They only had the police cars right in front of the Federal Reserve building. The other side of us, which there's another street on, there were no police cars there, but they were all pointed, all the cars were parked, pointed toward the park where we were holding our peaceful assembly. And I made a comment to one of my friends, you know, I think those police cars are pointed the wrong direction. And it would definitely be nice to see that kind of justice sought as well, but let's first get the transparency we need, and let's get back onto a commodity standard dollar.
Well, and I think it's concerning to see what will happen if these bills pass, if the audit is conducted. First of all, you know, will we be able to make all this information available to the American people? You know, that would be the goal, to make sure everyone sees the results of the audit. And then what will they call for? Obviously, they'd be furious. You know, Ford said it's on the back of one of Liberty First Apparel shirts if the American people found out exactly how our monetary system is run, there'd be a revolution tomorrow morning. So what would be their efforts? What would they call for? And then, you know, what would the establishment allow to happen? What would they be forced to do by the American people? I think it's an exciting and an interesting development.
Sure is. We have from Eric in Blacksburg, Virginia, and he asked a question that actually we had already mentioned before, but maybe he came on late. Is Paula Stang of any relation to the late Alan Stang? And, of course, the answer is yes on that. And then Johnny in Bakersfield asked, of the $700 billion bailout, how much money was created because of fractional reserve banking?
Well, I think that would be something certainly that an audit could tell us. It's difficult to say, you know, Trey was mentioning how much is actually printed of our currency, 2%. I think most of it, as he was saying, was they just enter digits, you know, in a computer system. So it's also interesting to wonder, well, how much of that $700 was from our tax dollars? Obviously, our tax dollars don't cover all of what they spend. That's why they need the Federal Reserve. They don't have to choose anymore, as many governments in past history have done, between guns and butter. They can choose both. They just print the money to fund everything. So
well,
I think
the scarier question Johnny might want to ask is, how much of that $700 billion, wherever it came from, how much of that has then been multiplied through the fractional reserve banking system? And we're talking about $700 billion that we were told was going to, quote, financial institutions. These financial institutions, Bank of America, Chase Manhattan, et cetera, are given specific guidelines as to how they are to lend out money. How does the fractional reserve banking system perpetuate itself? When they get that money from the Federal Reserve, they multiply it. So does $700 billion immediately become $7 trillion? How does that number grow? And I think that is the much scarier question. You know, fiat currency is bad enough when it's being printed by the central bank. But then when the individual banks who receive the money from the central bank are then authorized to multiply it tenfold, or whenever they receive a deposit are able to lend out 90% of the check on top of allowing the person who deposited the money to still access their funds, and I say allowing with quotations, that probably would be, for me, a much more interesting thing to find out and a much scarier situation to address.
It's really mind-boggling trying to follow the numbers. And I was telling Trey the other day, I don't understand how they've been able to make it work for this long. And I was actually, I'm reading In the Fed right now by Ron Paul. And, you know, he wonders the same thing. And he knows that, he talks about in his book that he knows that some sort of collapse will happen because the Austrian economists have been right again and again. This system, it can't last. It's not sustainable. So with how much money they've created over the past 100 years, and then just with our current situation right now, I think they've, well, I was reading in the book again, they've doubled the money supply in just a year or two. So I think it really is at a precipice.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things that I find this interesting, and the next person that had a question, or maybe it's more of a comment, but the people that are out of this country, they get more complete news about what's going on in our country and around the world than we do. It almost seems like in many cases it may be a little less managed, or somehow they get information. But a lot of times the headlines over there are not even mentioned in our papers or through our news outlets, or they might be just a very small item that you could just about miss. But we have Phil from London, England, who always has astute comments. He says, the British pound is also falling. We are creating money out of thin air as well. Your president is about to sign a phony agreement in Copenhagen. What will the Americans do when they wake up and realize their president passed the sovereignty of the USA to a foreign power, the UN? Best always.
Well,
a lot of our presidents have passed a lot of sovereignty over to the United Nations and to other international institutions. Go ahead, Paul.
Well, yes, definitely. I think that's one reason why it's concerning to think about what will their response be, because they've been conditioned. This has happened over and over and over. And, you know, I think when they find out what's going on, again, as many people as we've talked about have become awake. You know, we were talking about the G20 meeting. We heard that, you know, because of all the protests that went on and the backlash, that maybe they've slowed and they may not sign whatever they were going to sign at this meeting, whatever their plan was, we're not sure. So our efforts definitely, we see that they forestall them and keep them on their toes, and that's encouraging for sure.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the first thing that you said when you were talking about Phil was that that often other countries are able to get more factual or more telling information through news outlets than we are. You know, that, again, is the power of the Internet. You know, we're able to stay plugged in. If we want to know the information, if we want to look for it, we can find it. I wish that, you know, the headlines here read better, but, you know, you look at any large state newspaper, I mean, the media outlets, they have an incentive to keep the status quo. They want to continue to be the big dog. They want to continue to be empowered through the government. And if the government, you know, is the hand that is feeding them, they're not going to bite it. And so I think that, again, that's where we come back to the Internet being such a powerful source. Like Paula said, the Copenhagen Treaty, I think much like the swine flu vaccine, has been getting so much negative publicity on the Internet through the news feed that I pay the most attention to, which is my Facebook news feed. You know, it's been getting a lot of negative press, if you will. And I think that it may not happen. It may be slowed. But when it does go through, if it does go through, the American people will have a huge backlash. But the question is, which American people, how loud, and will they be given a voice? I was part of more than 20 Tea Parties this year. And most of them in different states, including the big one on the 12th of September in Washington, D.C. And there was hardly ever any media there. And although the message was not a refined, centralized message, you know, most of us were there for our own issues, there were still a lot of people there that were simply outraged at government in general, simply outraged at the fact that for the first time in world history there was a government formed through the power of individuals went upward, not the other way around. And in only 100 years, we flipped that around to where they no longer listen to us. An overwhelming majority of, I believe it was Barbara Boxer's constituency, called and said, do not vote for the bailout, yet she still voted for it. And I know how Texans felt about it, to still have our senators vote for it. So, you know, it's... There is not always going to be the media coverage of the outrage, but that doesn't mean the outrage isn't there. And the more and more stuff they try and cram down our throats, and the less information that they produce, the less information that they let out there, and the more people that wake up to it, the less credibility they have. And so I think it'll be good. I think that only good can come from evil, because of the way there are greater powers at work. And so you get some information that isn't accurate, or there's information missing, and people begin to turn off their televisions and go look elsewhere.
Yeah, I was just reading recently, a CIA, I think it was a former director, said that every major member of the media is in the CIA's pocket. And, you know, American citizens may not directly realize that, but they realize that something is missing and that they're not getting the full story. And the more reading that everyone does, the better it is. I mean, whether it's from, you know, newspapers or blogs from other countries, as the person who asked the question was speaking of, whether it's one of their magazines or our own, you just read as much as you can from wherever you can get it, and you compare, and you think for yourself, and that's really important.
I think a good example of that's ClimateGate. You know, you don't hear about that anywhere here, but all the articles you do read are in other countries. So, you know, there are people that are waking up to it. The people that I have spoken with who live in London, the people who live in the few in Australia and other countries, they tell me, they say, you know, that they completely discredit their government-run media outlets. They know which ones carry no weight, no water anymore. I mean, I had a friend very involved in computers and stuff like that. And I brought up ClimateGate to him, and he had never heard of it. He's like, what? There were some people that found falsified documents. You never hear about it in the national media. But that information is growing rapidly on the Internet, and the more people that hear about it, ask the question, why don't I hear about this in the evening on Fox News? Why don't I hear about this on CNN? They're looking for it and not seeing it, and that's creating an atmosphere of distrust between the American people and their trusted media sources.
Right. It's almost entertaining. As the days go by, they just incriminate themselves because they're not giving the full story. They're not telling the American people, you know, the real news. And each issue that comes up, people are discovering that. Well, why isn't the major news talking about that? You know, someone that watches Fox News and maybe reads a little bit on the Internet, if they see this on the Internet and Fox News doesn't cover it, that definitely lights a light bulb above their head. What is going on here?
And undoubtedly, when we say this, I'm sure that there are big media outlets that eventually cover these things. You know, Paul and I see
right.
things on the Internet, and 3 weeks later it'll be on national television because it's gotten so big they can't ignore it anymore. They have to report on it. Otherwise, it becomes extremely apparent that they're guarding us from the truth.
Right, right.
It's almost like the tail wagging the dog eventually. Yeah. Paul Stramer was a guest with us, I think about a week ago, if I remember right, and he's from Eureka, Montana, and he asked, have you heard anything about a bank holiday plan for January 15th, which was leaked by one of Obama's advisors?
I have not heard anything about that. It certainly did not work when Roosevelt did it during the Great Depression. Bank holidays are not helpful.
Yeah. Okay.
Trey, have you heard anything about it?
I have not.
Okay.
Well, I guess we'll just stay tuned on that one and see if there's any more information that'll become available. Maybe it's possible on some things like that to Google it and see if anything comes up. Maybe somebody wrote something about it somewhere.
Right.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying I'm definitely interested now. My interest has peaked. I'm going to have to go read about that. You know, when Roosevelt did it during the Great Depression, people, they closed the banks, and then he even extended it even longer, I think with a presidential proclamation, and people were not allowed to withdraw money from their banks. They weren't allowed to write checks to pay their bills. I mean, this is not helpful to anyone.
Certainly not. Well, Paul also says here, in 1980, gold was $8.50 per ounce, and silver was $50 per ounce, which was its normal ratio of about 16 to 1. What do you see happening to precious metal prices, especially silver, at this time?
Well, Trey is, as we're preparing to get married, he's kind of in charge of our income and what we spend it on, and he has definitely been buying silver.
Yeah, I've been, because of the ratio, I've been more of a silver advocate. But there, of course, are a lot of different things that affect the metals market. I mean, obviously, gold being so expensive, although it's a better conductor of electricity, is not used in photoelectronics as much as silver is. So silver has industrial use, industrial capability, and the fact that it is so much less expensive, people buy it in a lot larger volumes. So silver's price is held low a little bit by that. Also, you have all the hype about gold, all the talk about gold, get into gold, get into gold. And, of course, I think for most people, including myself, when I say get into gold, I mean precious metals in general. But most people, they hear the word gold and they don't know, you know, what does that mean about palladium? What does that mean for platinum? What does that mean for silver? And, you know, I follow Peter Schiff, and I read a lot of information on the Von Mises website. And there's definitely been a disconnect in gold and silver. I still consider silver to be undervalued. It's doubled in the last year. Gold has gone up substantially as well, but it hasn't hit double yet. So I mean, you have to just keep reading and try and educate yourself as much as possible. I went to a summit, Mises Institute summit. I don't really like the word summit. That's probably not what they called it, but it was an event in Dallas. And at that event, one of the gentlemen was up there. He said, "You know, I'm an Austrian economist. I have been for 20 years. I watch this stuff." And, you know, you try and guess what is going to happen with an investment. You know, how does this, in that situation, how did Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, how did the Federal Reserve's decisions to expand credit to lower interest rates. How is that going to affect, for instance, the real estate market? And he said, you know, I was able to use that information that I was able to extract to realize I needed to be in real estate. He said the problem was I didn't know when it was going to end. I stayed in Vegas a little too long, and I lost a property. You know, I lost a ton of value, and I personally ran into that a whole bunch. And you can't. It's hard to predict what commodities are going to do. It's hard to invest in really anything these days because you don't know what's going on behind the scenes. You don't know how much the International Monetary Fund is affecting the price of gold and the price of silver. Are they dumping it? Are they buying it up? They threaten to dump it, and gold prices, you know, drop. It's so manipulated because we don't have a free market anymore. There is no safe investment. In 2008, everything went down. Gold, silver, real estate, stocks. There was nothing that didn't that I'm aware of. I mean, everything fell at once because everything is compared to the dollar, and everything is compared to this fake stack of cards that seems like it's something that it is, and it seems bigger than it is. I'm no expert on it. If it returns to the 16-to-1 ratio, that would be great for our holdings.
Mm-hmm. Well, Zach in Deer Park asked a question that kind of falls on the heels of something you were just saying a minute ago. What inspiration can be said to capitalism in these days and with our current economical standing?
Well, I mean, is that question, I'm trying to interpret it, if by, you know, what inspiration can there be for capitalism? We haven't seen capitalism. It's been a long time. What we've seen is social corporatism. We've seen a marriage between government and companies. Ayn Rand said in an interview in the 60s that I watched, I think it was Mike Wallace or somebody, she said that the most obtrusive phenomena is one where government is married to a corporation. And I think that that's more what we're seeing. You know, we say, well, that's capitalism. We use this word capitalism so often to define a person who gets into business and makes money, when I can tell you firsthand that pretty much all but one venture I've been involved in business has been highly regulated, and a few even squelched by government. And so it's hard to use the barometer of looking at the economy and saying, well, does capitalism work? Does socialism work? Does, you know, this behind the scenes corporatism work? And calling one thing another, and it makes it so difficult. I don't think we've seen capitalism in our country for a very, very long time.
Yeah, and it is so frustrating for us as we watch the news and we hear them blame things on capitalism, and we're yelling, this is not capitalism. I have this argument with one of my economics professors, and he said, well, we don't really know if communism or socialism doesn't work, and we don't really know if capitalism doesn't work because we've never truly had them. I mean, these things, when we hear these things, they're so frustrating.
Well, you know, because people, they don't look into things. They don't read. You know, I've read more in the last year than I've probably read in my life, so I'm not pointing fingers and saying, you know, that these people are bad. But at some point, you got to wake up. At some point, you got to start reading. I think, you know, that happened for me. Ludwig von Mises wrote Human Action, and I started with that book. I don't recommend that. I should probably not start with it. It's really heavy, and I've had a hard time getting through the pages. But he breaks everything down to the simple concept that a person's actions are predicated on a belief that they are going to basically move from a position of uncomfortability to less uncomfortability, a position of more pleasure. And I think that if you just base something off of that small principle, that philosophy, you can easily see that individualism works better than collectivism, capitalism being a synonym for laissez-faire, economic system, works better than a system where you socialize everything, where you take away the incentive for one person to achieve by working harder and producing a better product. You know, Walmart does not produce a better product. You know, there's a reason they've achieved things. There's reasons that other companies have achieved things that have nothing to do with capitalism. They have to do with, you know, basically a gun and a bullet. You know, that's what government comes down to. It's compulsion. And whenever government compulsion enters the equation, it's no longer capitalism. It becomes a different beast. Is that beast corporatism? Is that beast socialism? Is it, you know, overt communism? We can look to history. We can look to different countries and see that the only true form of capitalism was probably right around the start of the United States. I was reading the other day something about the fact that you couldn't even be a corporation in its deception unless you could show that you were going to do something for the common good. And I believe it was either Carnegie or Rothschild or Rockefeller who really had a problem with that and had that policy changed.
Right, and it's so frustrating as words become people, they often, I find in my school and people of my age, they don't know what certain words mean. And Trey and I even kind of fell to this as well. We were thinking for, Obama is several things, but socialist, he's a socialist. And I realized, wait, no, he's not a socialist. This is fascism. This is other things. It's not just what we think of as socialism, and it's not...
If it's socialism, here's my check on the... You know, it can't be socialism if you're privatizing the profit while socializing the risk. But did we understand Zach's question properly?
I think that's what he was getting at, that, you know, a little bit on how we can view a capitalism, and I would, you know, say the free market is another way. I think you addressed it correctly by saying that we have not had the free market for so long, way back at the beginning, probably. What has really failed has been interventionism. The more interventionism, the worse things get. And the media is fond of using what the conditions of today to say, well, see how it's been failing? We just need more regulation. It's just so funny how they do that.
You see that the Democrats blame Republicans, Republicans blame the Democrats, and it goes back and forth. Well, you know, Bush overspent, and that put us in second position. Well, you know, the Federal Reserve during the Clinton administration had Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac lower their restrictions, and we passed equal opportunity lending and housing, et cetera, and everybody wants to blame, you know, left or right. When the fact is, it really comes down to top or bottom. The guys at the top made the bad decisions, and we at the bottom are the ones who are feeling the result of it.
Yeah, it seems like it's a real trap to get caught in the polarities, and that is a typical thing, kind of a divide and conquer, where people are so busy duking it out, and they both got it wrong. Neither one is practicing a pure form of that would support liberty in its maximum extent. They have a piece of it, but then they infringe it on it on the other end, and then they end up, you know, arguing with each other of how much interventionism, with the basic assumption already that we're going to have interventionism, but how much and what type?
what level of statism? You know.
Exactly.
These companies, and of course banks, they depend on interventionism. I mean that was one of the stated purposes at Jekyll Island. I mean they wanted the government, they wanted the taxpayer to be the bailout mechanism for when fractional reserve banking and fiat currency eventually caught up to them. Because I mean it's a pattern. If you take a builder that's building a house and you give him a stack of bricks and you say build this house with these bricks, and when he's not looking you come in the evening and you cut all the bricks in half and you say, hey look, you have twice as many bricks. He's going to get somewhere along building that house and realize that, in fact, he does not have more bricks. And I think that's what we do with the monetary system. That's how the business cycle is perpetuated, is we keep going in and we cut these dollars in half. We clip the coins and we make them look as though they're still a complete dollar. And I say we as though it's the government. It's not even the government that's doing it. It's a private entity that's doing it. And that it's a cycle, and it continues to happen and perpetuate and get worse and worse and worse. And I think every time that there is an adjustment, a recession, a depression, I think that is when the sifting happens, and that's when most of the wealth really starts showing where the wealth was transferred as it catches up. And, you know, we say, well, how does it keep happening? That question was raised earlier. How does that keep I think the recessions and the depressions, that's how it keeps happening. We have to have these times when prices go up as a result of a huge increase in capital flow or in cash flow that's not based off of any actual increase in value. Meanwhile, the rest of us, we put in our labor, you know, we plant a seed, it grows a fruit, that's real value that's being produced, and that just gets siphoned away.
Yeah, we have, let's see, this seems like a perfect question at this time. Jim Prentice from Lehigh Acres, Florida, asked, Paula and Trey, can you be contacted to help network across America? So maybe any contact information that you guys have, be sure and give that out now.
Sure. We both are on Facebook. You know, feel free to look us up, Paula Stang or Trey Stinnett. My last name is Stinnett. You can email us through our corporate website, which is libertyfirstapparel.com. If you just do info@libertyfirstapparel.com, we both will get that, and that can open conversation and we can really start networking. I think that there's, you know, the meetup groups, meetup.com, facebook.com. And there's all these different websites that facilitate getting people together. Lehigh Acres, I lost 10 properties there. So that if you live there, you probably understand fiat currency and fractional reserve banking firsthand.
Okay. I know we have, we're just a little over an hour now, and if I could, there's a few more questions. If we could indulge you for a little bit longer, would that be okay?
That'd be fine.
Sure.
Oh, okay, great. We have Deep from Detroit ask, why hasn't the inflation hit us yet the way it should, given the amount of money created?
Well, I think because it's been specialized. Okay, we don't know where the money went. We discussed that earlier, that a lot of this money filtered through the Federal Reserve's fingers. We don't know where they put it. I can't remember which congressman it was, but he asked Bernanke directly, tell me the recipients of the funds, and he said no. And I think that because we've had all this money that's just gone out there, and it's gone specially into these corporations like Goldman Sachs and these banks, that we have already seen some inflation. It just hasn't been across the broad spectrum. I think it's been in the stock market. I think a lot of the money has been put onto balance sheets and it just sits there. I think a lot of the money has gone into stock market manipulation. If you just look at the MCADs for stock investors, if you just look at how much of the trading is being done by the largest holders, you'll see that there's a lot of stock market manipulation going on right now. You see a lot of trust, a lot of faith in these companies because they're showing black profits. The state of Texas showed that we were in the black because it used bailout funds, for instance. Our governor told everybody we didn't take any, but we actually did take the bailout funds. And I think that's the reason we haven't seen the price of milk go up yet, is because right now that money hasn't gone out into the market. Lending is still tight. There's still a lot of restrictions on the little guy. And the small businesses that make up 80% of lending and loans and business transactions and employment, when that money starts to be lent out and trickle down to all of us, I think that's when inflation, the hyperinflation we're all worried about and scared of, is actually going to start hitting. And, you know, that's going to be your prices that are going up. But we've already seen it a little bit in the stock market. I don't think that has gone up solely out of consumer confidence. I know they did a little bit of a swap back, I believe, in March on which stocks are in the Dow and which ones are in the NASDAQ to make the number a little bit higher, but I think most of it has come from money sitting on balance sheets and manipulation.
Okay. Want to remind everybody again that we're speaking with Trey Stinnett and Paula Stang. And if you do have a question, we're drawing closer to the end of the webinar, but I know people have been weighing in throughout this webinar, and if you do want to weigh in with either a question or a comment, if you're on the phone line, hit *2 on your phone keypad, and we'll unmute your line. If you're online, then just type it in the question box and hit submit so that we'll see your question. And with that, we have Frank in Long Beach, who says, an excellent book that will clearly define the terms you're discussing is Uncommon Sense by William James Murray. Do either of you have a comment on that, or are you familiar with it?
I actually have not. I think I've heard of it. I have not read it. You know, with this paper that I just finished, I really introduced myself to a lot of different books that I hadn't heard of that were very helpful. The main one I can think of for the Federal Reserve would be The Creature from Jekyll Island by G. Edward Griffin. But that's a book that I'll have to look up. I have not read that one.
That's the second time I've heard that title in the last week. So third time I might buy it. No, I'm kidding. I'll check that out as well.
Yeah, we'll have to look into that.
Yeah, I've heard of it mentioned before, too, and I haven't read it either. So it sounds like it would do us all good to check that one out.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just agreeing.
Oh, okay, great. Bud and Tustin ask, if one wants to purchase silver, what form of it is thought to be the best value to be able to barter or sell? In case of a dollar collapse or devaluation, how does this get affected if the government calls in gold or silver? Is there a way to hold and avoid such a problem?
Well, I know when they were calling in gold between FDR's decision and Bretton Woods, that we were still able to hold new and static valued coins, that is, coins that were printed and released before a certain date. When they do that, they're going to say they legalize coins, but they typically, I know other countries have done it as well, they nominate specific dates as this is a new and static value, they have it more than a certain number of years. I don't know what that time frame is. So anybody that's buying silver and is considering that as a possibility, something they're afraid of, they should probably look into that. I also know that if you're buying silver with dollars at a store or at a gun show, you're probably not going to be on a government database for owning silver. You're probably not going to be seen as owning it. So you just have to gauge your decision based on that. You know, when the time comes, will you be holding coins that, you know, are illegal to have? And, you know, are those coins registered somewhere? Do they know how many you have? Because it becomes difficult to trace. You know, I just gave some silver to somebody for their wedding. You know, so if the government wanted to come take all my silver, they would say, well, where are those coins? You just, you know, you had those. So, I mean, it becomes difficult for the government to do, for them to track. I'm not saying anyone should do anything illegal. Now, as far as holding value, trading value, et cetera, a lot of people, they like to get junk silver, which is your coins that contain a portion of silver. None of them are 99.9. I think a lot of them are 60, 70, 80% silver. That's going to be your cheapest value because you're not paying as much of a premium. You're paying pretty much spot price times the percentage silver content. So right now, spot price on silver, I think, is like $18.50. So if you've got an 80% coin, you know, you're going to get $3 off, basically. So whereas if you buy straight bullion, which I've invested in both, you're going to pay a premium. You know, if you get bullion that has an American stamp on it, meaning the federal government backs the fact that this is, in fact, you know, 1 troy ounce of silver, then, you know, you're going to pay a premium on that as well. You're going to pay an extra $2 or $3. So, you know, I've as a new precious metals investor, you know, I've only been at it for about 18 months. I try and diversify my knowledge and diversify my holding because I don't know, you know, which one at the end of the day is going to provide me with the best, you know, the best value. I do know that if it has a stamp on it that's well recognized, Pan American Silver, American Precious Metal Exchange, those stamps, they're easier to trade. Of course, U.S. coins from the early 1900s are also extremely easy to move around.
Well, also, you know, it's always good to buy as a hedge against inflation, but I personally do not, you know, we're worried about a lot of things happening. I personally do not foresee them calling in gold like they did during the Great Depression. This is actually a recent victory that we had that Ron Paul helped work on. I think it was, I'm sure you have heard of what I'm talking about, in the, I think it was the late 70s or early 70s that it became legal again to buy gold. So I don't foresee them calling, demanding that everyone send in their gold. You know, during the Great Depression, if you owned gold, if you used gold, you could be put in jail for up to 10 years or be fined $10,000, which comparable to our money was, I think, $400,000. So, I mean, this is a massive fine. And those types of measures, I don't think they would be able to get past the American people.
Okay. Woody in Ventura, California, asked, how can we maximize the efforts of the recent Continental Congress 2009? Is this the way to go?
I've heard about the Continental Congress. I actually have not been following them as well. So I actually am not sure if I have an answer to that. Trey?
Same thing. I was in California recently, and someone was talking to me about it. The response that I heard to it was, you know, that there are a lot of different options. I mean, there's three state projects. There's people that are trying to take out all of Congress. There's people that are, you know, they're coming up with all different ideas.
Right.
I'm not well versed in the Constitutional Congress. I think it's a great idea to spread awareness of our current Constitution. You know, so I don't really have a direct answer for that as well.
Okay. Yeah, I think a lot of people are wondering about that. If, you know, maybe didn't only peripherally knew about it, and then it certainly didn't get any media or any real coverage. But it's still, I guess, some of the ideas and how to proceed are still under development, and they may reconvene again, so maybe in the spring. So I'm not really sure where it's all going to go either. But I guess we'll just have to stay tuned on that. I have, Vision Seeker in Neverland says, hyperinflation is inevitable, so how do we buy food when no one will take dollars? Argentina will not take dollars from tourists.
And that comes back to owning a commodity. That's, you know, the brilliant thing about gold and silver. A lot of other commodities have been tried, but you're talking about a non-reproducing element here. I mean, silver and gold are produced in supernovas, and I think that most people across the world, they associate a value to gold and silver. You'll always be able to use that. You know, as currency, sometimes not direct currency. Say you're in Venezuela, whatever, and you can't, you know, cash your dollar in for their dollars. You can't convert that. Well, right now you can still convert it to silver. You can still convert it to gold, and then I guarantee you'll be able to convert your gold and silver into other currencies.
Right.
So that's the reason a lot of people are stacking up on junk silver is when it all comes down. If it all comes down, we'll be prepared to purchase things with real money.
Also, if we came down to a commodity where, you know, the dollar wasn't accepted, you know, the market is amazing. Individual people will find a way to trade things. Obviously, gold over thousands of years was the best medium to use. Different things like food are more difficult to exchange for or to buy things with because it's not uniform and not easily divisible, et cetera. But I think individual people, they find a way to trade and to barter.
Yeah, I think barter is big. I'm hearing more and more people bartering. And I think that's the way we're headed. I really do. I was wondering... And maybe this would be more towards Trey. How do you feel about stocks, real estate, gold, those types of things?
Well, you know, like I said, they all have been manipulated over the long run. And so it's hard to gauge them by looking at their performance to say which one is the best to invest in. Paula used the phrase hedge against inflation. I've heard that assigned to everything, real estate, stocks, gold coins. I think that the real estate market is completely hyped up on government intervention. I really think that when I look at the real estate market now from a different perspective, I see a bunch of houses values. I see them standing on chopsticks. You know, if it's going to break, they're going to fall. But then they don't, because then there's some new government intervention. There's some new loosening of credit. You know, what's next? The Fed's interest rates are going to be negative. Are they going to start paying us to get loans? You know, how low is it going to get to try and flood the market with money? You look at supply and demand. If the supply stays constant and the demand increases, then the price goes up, and vice versa. So you had a great overbuild in real estate, while at the same time you had a lot of people who had access to money that they should not have had that access to money. I'm one of them. I bought properties with stated income, stated asset. They didn't look at credit, and I did not have adequate finances to own some of the properties. So when push came to shove, when it all came down, it was decide, do I keep the house that I live in, or do I keep my investment property? And I think that's the reason that real estate prices, they've gone down, because people realized that money was not based on real wealth. And if money isn't based on real wealth, I talked about the split bricks earlier. If it's not based on something true and something created from man's sweat, or something that came from the earth, then if it's just created out of thin air, then eventually those commodities are going to drop. So everything dropped across the board. I don't trust the stock market, because it can be so controlled and so manipulated. I have friends that make six figures in the stock market. I just personally have an abhorrence for something that I have to pay that much attention to. Real estate, you can make a lot of money in real estate. You can stay in real estate. I still have properties. The difference is I bought those properties based on a cash flow model of I have more money coming in on rent than I'm paying out on my mortgage. If the value of that property gets cut into one-tenth, and my $500,000, property becomes worth $50,000, it does not matter to me if I'm getting enough cash flow in to afford the mortgage. It may hurt my pride at night to think that I paid, 10 times something's value, but I'm not going to lose that property, and I'm not going to have to dip into my pocket. Paul is not going to have to not have a nice wedding because I spent, too much money on the asset, as long as I have that cash flow coming in. So real estate, I can safely stay in it despite the value fluctuations if I'm looking at it through a cash flow model, rental homes, things like that. My problem in real estate was that I fell for the temptation of appreciation. You see a property in California go from $100,000 to $1 million in 10 years, you want to be part of that. And I think that's a temptation to avoid, because things like that only happen with manipulation. They only happen when there is an increased amount of interest. And when I say interest, I mean speculative buyers. And if those speculative buyers are natural and they're coming here because of population growth, or they're coming here because there's been more wealth transferred to the states, well, then that's fine. But if you can see that it's only happening because the government is forcing more money into people's pockets and bank accounts, and forcing banks to give loans to people who don't deserve them, then you can kind of see where that's going. Gold and silver, I think it was one of the gentlemen earlier, I mentioned that in 1981 or 1980 that silver's worth $50. Well, that's not good today. I mean, if you bought it then, your value is only $19-$20. So, is it always a perfect hedge against inflation? No, it's not, because even gold and silver can be manipulated. But right now, that's where I'm converting my dollars, because I don't see something other than into my own business where I'm putting a lot of money. I don't see something that I can create value out of and know that value isn't being inflated by an institution of government or the Federal Reserve.
And the major enemy that we have, this power that the Fed controls of setting interest rates, this is what causes the boom and bust business cycle. And it's so upsetting when people just accept this is just a natural occurrence. But what causes this malinvestment that Trey was talking about is when the Fed sets artificially low interest rates and capital is moved to places where it shouldn't be, like he was discussing. And setting of the interest rates, that is something that with the removal of the Fed would certainly cause these boom and bust business cycles to stop.
Okay. We've got Chris in Long Beach. saying the Fed and central banks are attempting a massive engineered decline of the dollar. At the rate of word spreading regarding the world debt situation, when do you think the bottom will completely fall out of the dollar?
It's hard to speculate. You know, every time you see someone speculating on something like that, that date arrives and you're like, why isn't it here yet? I think we'll really start to know, again, by watching the money. Where are the people that have the most, that have the inside information? What are they doing with their money? What are they doing, you know, with their ownerships? They're not going to let a dollar fall while their values are still based in dollars. So I think you just have to watch. I don't think we're going to have a whole lot of foresight into it. We're not going to know 3, 4, 5, you know, years in advance, oh, look, this is when the dollar's going to fall out, be out of the dollar by, you know, 2015. I don't think there is a way to predict that, you know,
right,
because
even,
it's not natural.
Right, and even, you know, the Austrian economists, they've correctly predicted these different fallouts in the economy, but even they can't correctly guesstimate exactly when the date might be, and that is certainly frustrating.
Yeah, some people like to look at skyscrapers, but that theory doesn't work either.
Well, I'd tell you, I really appreciate, you know, what you've shared with us today, and I know we could literally go on the rest of the day and into the evening, and you know, perhaps in the future we can move in all kinds of directions and cover some more ground. I actually do have one more question here from Paul Stramer in Eureka, Montana. He says, with gold at $1,200 per ounce, silver should be over $70 per ounce at its normal ratio throughout history until now. That ratio held even when silver was not a rare metal like it is today. Aren't the banks going to lose control of the short contracts they use to drive silver down at some point when the currency collapses? What would you say to that?
I think so. I mean, that's the reason that I chose silver over gold. I think that's, he has a pretty good handle on, you know, what's going on as far as the ratio and looking at it. But, you know, if you just look at the last couple hundred years, silver and gold ratios, I mean, it follows the same trend line, but they're not, you know, that ratio is not always constant. It's not always consistent. But you can pretty much know that silver is undervalued by looking at that, and the ratio can't get much further off. So I would say with great certainty that it can't really go much anywhere but up.
Okay. And Vision Seeker from Neverland asks, will bank safety deposits be safe from a bankrupt government? If they confiscate gold, will silver be safe?
I doubt it. I think that, Paula, do you know in the Great Depression if they confiscated silver as well?
I wrote an entire paper on this, and I cannot say for certain that silver was as well. I'm not positive.
I don't think silver will be safe. No, I think that, you know, precious metals in general will take up the mark. But again, you know, I said earlier that silver does have industrial purposes, so they can't completely remove it from the market. So they would have to figure out a way to still allow, you know, their child NASA to use silver in its electronic equipment. They still have to allow, you know, their connections with Nikon and Sony and the processor companies that are, you know, using silver and silicone to make their computers. I mean, you're talking about removing a metal that conducts electricity better than every other metal but gold. So removing silver would be more difficult. Removing gold, you know, they might do it. But I think Paula was probably correct earlier when she said that would be more difficult today than it was in the 30s.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess with that, what I wanted to do is of course, to once again thank both of you very much, and to say that if either of you has kind of a what you call a parting comment or something that you would wanted to have covered and didn't before, then in just a moment I want to give you that opportunity. And just to remind everybody that we do these webinars every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And this coming Tuesday, we're going to have David Morgan, who's with Stone Investment, or some know it as Silver Investor. And he is a fairly high profile as far as the information that he shares. And so it'll kind of follow up on the heels of some of the things that we've been talking about today. And so we'll have that, and we'll have also an equally fascinating guest for Wednesday and Thursday. So we invite everybody to join us next Tuesday. We start these webinars again for next week. The replay of today's webinar will be found in our menu of webinars that we've had from the past, and I invite you to dig into that library and really check out the webinars that we've had in the past. You can download them. You can do an instant play. You can share them with others. And I wanted to, at this time, then to give each of you, if you'd like, to make a closing comment.
Want to go ahead, Sudar?
Sure. I think just a lot of what we were talking about the internet being such a great medium for information, and I tell Trey all the time, we constantly have to be watching what the government does. It seems like every day they do something worse. But, you know, every day that they do something, I think it awakens more people, and they become more upset and increasingly angry. And, you know, that is something that we want to see. We want to see people become passionate and read more and find out what's going on. So, you know, every day that the government passes a new act that we don't like, I think there's a rebellion among people, and they feel like they have to wake up and do something about it. And that is definitely exciting and encouraging, and I'm so happy to get to be a part of it.
Great. I would say that, you know, it is important. Everybody that listens to this, and everybody that, you know, is a subscriber to Republic Magazine, they're people who love liberty. They're people who love their life, and they want to see this country, for the most part, be as free as possible, to be as it was when it first started. And I would encourage anyone who's listening to this to get involved. You know, not only politically. You know, you should absolutely be on juries. You should absolutely be precinct chairmen. You should be involved at every level that you can of your government. Run for city council. You know, get involved at any level that you can, because we need liberty-minded, liberty-focused people to be involved in government. But at the same time, you know, use your free time, use your social time to do that. I mean, there are people in the liberty movement that they all find their niche. And I recommend that everybody that listens to this, they find their niche. You know, I have friends that are making videos. I have a guy who's trying to make a liberty-oriented movie. People that are getting speaking auditions, writing songs, doing music, going to events, flash mobs. I mean, it's the reason that we started Liberty First Apparel. We wanted to put the ideas of liberty onto a canvas that people would wear to the mall. You know, the signs that we were seeing at the tea parties, they were good. They had good messages, but nobody carries a sign to the mall. Nobody, you know, puts a sign on the top of their car. But T-shirts and bumper stickers, that was my thought, was, you know, this is a way to spread the message of liberty in a non-obtrusive way, to be able to get the word out there for the people who aren't scouring Facebook, you know, to make, you know, liberty and patriotism is not antiquated. It's not my granddad's American flag T-shirt. You know, it's something real. You know, and I think too often we have leaders that hide behind our sense of patriotism, hide behind the American flag to try and pull things over on us. And I think that we need to really embrace what liberty truly is. And that's why we started Liberty First Apparel. That's why other people are getting involved and finding their niche and how to spread the message in that. And I would say that I would ask everybody that's listening to this that find your inspiration and do the same.
That's great. It really is. I meant to ask: is there a website or websites that people can go to? I don't know if I heard you give any websites out.
There is. We are, like I said, very involved in our local community. We're very involved in the liberty movement, and we want to spread the message of liberty. We're so busy, though, that we haven't had time to really blog. We've been so focused on the business. Our website is libertyfirstapparel.com, and we are a mostly T-shirt company, but we're taking the hip urban edge that you see on most T-shirts in the mall and at Nordstrom and on the racks that people wear because they think it looks cool, but we're combining that. We're marrying it with the pure healing message of liberty and trying to get that out there. libertyfirstapparel.com. And the reason I chose that name was, out of all things, all decisions that are made, government, for my family, everything that I do day in and day out, I have to consider first liberty. And so I thought, you know, what is it? Is it pro-liberty or is it anti-liberty? You know, everything else doesn't matter. It's, you know, they talk about how much we should or shouldn't spend on health care. We talk about, you know, if the ballot should be $700 billion or if it should be a trillion. You know, what about liberty? You know, that's where we have to look first, then make all of our decisions based on that.
That's great. I like that. I really do. Is there, and it's fine if you, if there's not one you want to give out, but is there anything like a, either a phone number or an email address for any type of contact, or would you rather keep that private?
No, we invite any conversation. We are in our 20s, so we don't talk on the phone that much. We do a lot of email, so feel free to email either of us, Paula or Trey, at libertyfirstapparel.com, or you can reach both of us through info@libertyfirstapparel.com.
Great. Okay. Well, I really appreciate it, and it's certainly refreshing to hear what you've been doing, and I look for terrific things ahead. And like I said, perhaps in the future we can have you back again and continue the conversation. So with that, I thank both of you and everyone that was on the webinar today, and hopefully we'll see you all this coming Tuesday for our next webinar. Everyone have a wonderful day. Thank you.
Thanks, Earl.
Bye-bye.
The moderator has left the conference.